Welcome everyone to Good Areas Live. Jared Kimber here. Weird time for Wagga Wheel, but we're fitting them in wherever we can. Me and Robbie were talking for ages today, and I had some other stuff going on as well. But here I am. So if you're joining us live on YouTube, if you're not, and it's just coming in your earphones, maybe Wagga Wheel is always a weird time for you. I don't know. I don't really know how your life works and how these things go. This is just where we are. If you wanted to ask a question and you're on the YouTube, the best way to do it is a super chat while we're doing this. But if not, the best way is always via Patreon. Good Areas Podcast on Patreon. You can support us there. It's what fuels this network at the moment as we go. And Neil has fueled us by saying, just how high is Washington Sundar's ceiling? Knowing how long it takes all-rounders to develop, seems like he has a leapfrog Akshar Patel in the Indian setup. It's a good question. I don't think he's quite Ravi Jadeja level. I don't know if his batting's that far off Ravi Jadeja. That doesn't mean he'll get to that level, of course. But if you look at it from a natural talent point of view, some ways he's got more of a free-flowing nature to his batting, whereas Jadeja's always been a little bit staccato, I think, is a batter. Maybe one of the best ways of looking at him. So I definitely think there's that. As a bowler, I suppose his ceiling is Ashwin with Jadeja's batting, and his floor is, I'm trying to think of a good option here. I don't know. His floor's not very, maybe he's already at his floor, right? Like, I can't imagine he gets that much worse than he is now. So, I think he's a fantastic cricketer, and history will hopefully reflect that I mentioned over and over again. I thought he was a fantastic cricketer when everyone told me he was a dud. Arvind says, feels like the Intercontinental Cup played a huge part in Ireland, Afghanistan getting test status. Is there any chance of it being brought back in the future? And if not, is it really a pathway for the next cricket nation to get test status? By the way, I completely understand your opinion about the uselessness of the concept of test status, but since this is reality, yeah, no, that's fair. I don't know if it did. I would have to go back and have a look. My guess is that we have international, that we have those teams because they were good in World Cups. Maybe I'm wrong. I just think they were consistently good enough that it was hard to ignore them. Look, you're probably right. The International Cup played a small part in it. I don't think the people who give test status were looking at the International Cup, though. I could be. And maybe the International Cup, because it existed, Aravind, meant that those teams were better, right? That I probably would grant you. But yeah, I don't think that's why they got test status. The last team that got test status because of how good they were in first class cricket would be Pakistan. Yeah, Pakistan. What was that, in the late 50s? Because every other team after them, Sri Lanka was a World Cup, Zimbabwe was a World Cup, Bangladesh was a World Cup, and then the last two. So, yeah, maybe I look at it a little bit differently. James says, all out 27 notwithstanding, is the West Indies test team on the improve? It would be a hard call to make that right at the moment, James. What do I think about the West Indies as a cricket team? I don't think I think all that much differently than I did before they were 27 all out. I've said for ages they can bowl. They sometimes have some all-round talent available, you know, to them as well. They can't bat. And I don't think anything has changed there. So just before I came on this podcast, I had a look at our WhatsApp group and someone had put in that Clive Lloyd and Brian Lara have been called up to help the West Indies. Unless you're picking peak those two guys, I'm not sure it's going to help. That's not going to help, right? Most probably. Not because they're not smart people and they don't understand cricket or anything. It's not going to help because I would assume that the issue in the West Indies is that it's very hard to make runs in first-class cricket because the pitches are so weighted towards bowlers. That's mine. I mean, Mash and Santokhi are much in a better position to talk about that sort of stuff than I am. But if you're asking my opinion, that would be my guess. And so that's been the case for a very long time. I don't know if it's about to change. Mob says, we talk about cricket teams undergoing transitional periods, but what about the commentary teams? Could you please talk about the dynamics between bringing in recently retired players who understand how new cricket is actually being played by the players, like broad versus experienced broadcasters able to integrate similar out of the players? Yeah, it's a really weird one. I haven't worked in TV, so I don't know the whole Broad and Anderson thing, and Broad and Atherton thing that you're talking about here. You do get periods where commentary teams change quite a bit. Commentary teams don't actually work together that much. And I think that's one of the reasons cricket commentary isn't as good as it is in some other sports, where you get the same people working together over and over again for maybe 7-8 months of the year. We just don't get that in cricket. And so because of that, it doesn't improve as much. Really important that the person that you've got in understands why they are there, which I've always found really tough. I've seen players come in and struggle because they don't really know why they've been picked. And the second thing is that they're getting constant feedback. That's good. That's bad. This is why we do it this way. This is why we do it that way. What kind of commentator do you want to be? I think there's an early episode, Mob, of Robbie talking about that on Kim Upper, of trying to work out where you want to fit in. And I think that's one thing that it's really hard. If you know the industry really well, you kind of know who you want to be and how you want to be, right? Most people don't understand that. And so giving them that, you know, being like, oh, you're really good at this. Have you thought of this being your specialty? Or have you thought of this being your persona, right? Or this, you know, this is what you end up doing. I think that's a really important thing of these people having the ability to do that and to work that out. And I think sometimes what happens is, and why most famous players are not particularly good at commentary is because they're picked because they're famous players and they're not given feedback and they're not encouraged to learn the craft in an interesting way, and they're not told what kind of commentators they could be. Rob says, even without the back foot no ball rule making a comeback, would you recommend young fast bowlers having a back foot action? It should still be legal if their front foot lands behind the popping crease, right? Yeah, it's really hard to control though, Rob. So I actually played with a young kid recently who had this. He had a back foot sort of planting, Ray Linwell, Fidel Edwards, maybe you would say, type of action. You know, that's sort of somewhere maybe between those two. And he just kept bowling no balls. So you could technically do it, but you'd have to probably be a lot further back because you can't control your front step in the same way. But I'm trying to think. I'm sure there are other bowlers who kind of have that. Would Malinga have had that? No, he's probably more front foot, isn't he? It's really hard because you'd almost have to most people would be trained to do it the other way just because that's been the predominant for so long. Ian says, as India got closer than that, Jay, surely I wasn't the only one hoping we might get a tie with both innings being exactly level. Does any other sport promote nerdishness, which might not be a word, I think it is a word, in the way cricket does? So there's a thing, is it the NFL that has Scoregami, where fans are really excited because there's only so many scores that you can have in the NFL. And so it's really cool when you find a new score. That's one I know in the NFL. So I think, I mean, as a Denver Nuggets fan, like every time Jokic does a stat line no one else has ever done before, I think they call it Yokogami as well. So I think cricket probably has more varied versions of that, right? So there probably is an element of I would say that other sports don't have in the same way that cricket has. I mean, cricket's pretty high in the nerdishness, I would have thought. You know, it's on the podium. Ali says, what should be the plan strategy for countries like Italy, Namibia, and Netherlands, who mostly get their talent from established cricket centres like South Africa or Australia? Ali, as I've said a million times, this is how cricket starts in most countries in the world, right? This is not as new or as weird as people, I think, believe it to be or make it out to be or however you want to kind of look at those sorts of things. So what happens is Ireland started like this, right? And then over time, Ireland wasn't like that anymore. Scotland has started like this and they're moving on. Netherlands is already, Netherlands have got lots of young players coming up. You know, Bas de Lieder, Arjen Dutt, I'm missing someone really obvious in that too. So they've got lots of players coming through. You should be using all the players available to you in the same way that England use all the players available to them, right? That's the future of it. And then you make the system stronger. And when, you know, as Ireland showed, once you make the system stronger, then the Ireland players naturally start to come through. But that doesn't mean that you don't pick a player from another country who can still do really well. Like, I think you have to be smart. Sam says, the Football Cliches podcast is dedicated to the language of football, both commentary and online discourse. It is typically a somewhat acerbic but positive tone with an adjunction panel for validity of speech. Which cricket figures, players, or media would you suggest for a cricketing equivalent? It's a hard one, Sam, because I haven't listened to it. I'm aware of it existing, but I've never really listened to an episode of it. I suppose Daniel Norcross would be someone I would think that would be quite high up there. Monger is probably someone with a really good ear for that sort of stuff. Neil Manthorpe. Those are probably three guys that I would say that would make a lot of sense on a podcast like that. I'm trying to think if there's anyone else. There's probably some other one. Dave Tickner. I know, don't think he podcasts, but someone like Dave Tickner might be another one who sort of picks up those sorts of habits and everything else. Bumble's really, really good at that as well, I think. So there's probably a few different people off the top of my head. Will says, if England lose this series to India while Stokes continues to underperform with the bat, what percentage chance do you give them of changing the coach or captain before the Ashes? 0% chance. It's much more likely, actually, Will, that Stokes bats at 7. I think if they're going to make a change, I don't think they want to make it at the moment, partly because that gives them another left-hander. Because they've got Duckett and Stokes. So they probably don't want everyone right-handed in between those two guys. Up to number 7. I'm just guessing here, but I could see how that would be the case. But yeah, he's their best bowler at the moment. Like, he is, and he's still feeling really well, and he's a captain. He's definitely not going before the Ashes. They could still lose this series 3-2, I think. I don't want to say quite easily, because I suppose it'd be a hell of a comeback from India, but you know, there's a big chance of that. I'd be shocked if they changed anything before then. Sinoy says, the overrate in this current Patuti series seems to be a major talking point. Vaughan suggested that all 90 overs be played no matter what, which in a logistical sense is quite stupid. Players' fines seem pointless and WTC points deductions seem too extreme. What would you do to enforce real-time in-game implications of a slow overrate? The problem at the moment is that we still tackle slow overrates as a bowling and fielding team issue when it's a cricket issue. So that's the first thing I would be saying to everyone involved is you need to do that. The second one is there's a shot clock. You're a batter and you want to drink? Great. You've got a minute. If you're not back at your crease within that minute, 5-run penalty. If you're not ready to bowl within that 1 minute, unless there's an actual injury, 5-run penalty. You want to change your bat because your bat's broken. Okay. You've got a minute. I think those are the sorts of things that I would be looking at. I haven't, you know, gone deeply into this or anything else, but this is what I would say. First-class cricket and associate cricket does not have these same issues because the umpire is umpire. Maybe we could go back to that. James says, what qualities distinguish players who make it to the top level despite not being considered among the top prospects in age group cricket? I think one thing I would say is that, you know, I've got to get in touch with Sikandar Razza, don't I? So someone like Sikandar Razza is someone that probably comes to mind there, right? Or Bryce McGain would be another one. Tim Lindley's a really interesting one. He played a lot of county cricket. I tried to get him on the podcast, actually, but I'll try and catch up with him next time I'm in Leeds and see if I can do that. But those sorts of guys all were desperate to make it. And that desperation, when you have some talent, is also a really, really good thing. I think the players who get better as they're older are either just really good at constantly learning, where there are probably a lot of great players who are great at 20 and can pick up a few smaller things, but don't really change that much between 20 and 28. Whereas if you look at someone like Mike Hussey or Graham Gooch, they are probably adding to their skill sets all the way through. And so they are just better players in their 30s, right? So I think if you have players like that, And most of those players that we've mentioned before, some of those players, even Tim Lindley, Bryce McGain's probably the only one of the ones I mentioned there that wasn't in any kind of age group cricket, as far as I'm aware. I think even Sikandar was in some. So most of them are going to be in age group cricket, right? How you develop and where you develop, we still don't always know. This is a thing right across all sports, right? So at 17, Azhar Ali was not supposed to be a test match batter, right? Stuart Broad at 16 was not supposed to be a test match bowler. At best, there was an idea he might be like a Bo Webster type guy, and he's ended up with like a kabillion test wickets. Keeping smart, hungry, athletic, driven people in a professional system means that anyone can succeed. If you're just looking for greatness between 14 and 18, you'll find a lot of people who are great at 14 and 18. You won't find everyone else. And that's a really important thing, I think, that we need to understand when we're looking at younger players as a sport, but also just as a fan group, right? We'll be back on the Wagon Wheel after this. I once made a pair in a club game, which is almost impossible to do. But I have been obsessed with batting my entire life. And so I put that into my new book, The Art of Batting. Being that I'm not very good at that skill, I decided to talk to other people who were. So I hit up as many contacts as I could just to talk about batting. Rahul Dravid, Brian Lara, AB de Villiers, Kumar Sangakkara, Ross Taylor, Susie Bates, Nasser Hussain, Ian Chappell, and so many, many, many more. I wanted batters to talk about how they and their friends made runs, because that is the art of batting. All right, welcome back to the Wagon Wheel. Josh says, following your Who Will Make the Next World Test Championship final, I tried the predictor, which was in the description. It's really good, by the way, that description. I input your selections and changed the New Zealand series to home 3 versus 0 versus the West Indies, 2-0 versus India, 2-0 versus Sri Lanka, 1-2 versus England, 1-3 versus Australia, and 1-1 versus Pakistan. How blindly optimistic must I be to think New Zealand can have a perfect home record and end up in the final? They could. The West Indies one I have no issue with. I think the India one is very unlikely. And the Sri Lankan one is possible, I suppose. I think those things are possible. Sri Lanka has a pretty good bowling lineup as well. Especially Seambal, if all of them are fit and they play, and like I think they've got a lot of options. So you're being very optimistic, Josh. It's not impossible. What I'm trying to do is factor in current form, a little bit of projections, you know, but you're still taking a guess, aren't you? I think the comments that I received, my team received, I don't think I went on that piece, but was that we overestimated England. But remember, they were coming off a loss, so I knew that people were going to get upset with that, and we overestimated Sri Lanka. I do like Sri Lanka. I think they're a decent side, and they've got a very good home season, right? So, but yeah, New Zealand, I'd be shocked, honestly, if they made the next World Test Championship final. PJ says, if you were made CEO of Major League Cricket tomorrow, shout out to Johnny Graves, he's doing that job. What changes, decisions, or ideas would you make or implement over the next 1, 3, 5 years to see MLC become the second best and second most prestigious league and to make minor league cricket the best feeder development league that it can be? It's quite a fascinating one, minor league and major league cricket. I'm not as well placed as, you know, someone like Justin or Johnny, who are obviously over there working. The issue that I think they have is that their ownership groups are Indian and they're always going to point back to India, but it's a terrible time zone for India. So I think you really need everyone to buy in on the fact that this is what it is. And that maybe the only way to make it the second biggest league in the world is really up the players that you have playing over there. So you need probably 2 or 3 stars in every side. And that's where the IPL owners should come in handy. I'm trying to think of what else I would do. I don't know, PJ. I can't think of anything off the top of my head. I know that there's some stuff with... So they tried to do a deal with us where we could stream some stuff, but there were technical issues at our end. I just don't think they have the money or the manpower to pull off their very optimistic ideas that they have at the moment. When I've talked to Justin, what's his job? Vice president or something of the MLC? I don't know, whatever his title is. He's got a lot of great ideas. They just don't ever get, they don't have the money to pull them off. I spoke to Johnny once or twice as well. I thought both of those guys had a lot going for them. They see what I see. I don't know what that next step is from turning it from what it is at the moment, which is a bit of a pop-up tournament, into a really major, important thing. Sandeep says, have you had your hands and eyes on the latest VR tech to train batsmen, simulating various pitches and fields, and what are your thoughts? No, I haven't played with that at all. I played with some of the earlier ones, but I haven't seen any of it. If someone owns one of the VR training stuff for batters, I'm more than happy to have a look at it. But no, there was one in the press box a couple of years ago that the company asked me to try out for them, and it felt like a game. More than anything that was helpful. I definitely didn't feel like I was like watching cricket. Lemon says, do we have a chance? Do we have a chance that's created average for bowlers? Surely this is a more accurate way of showing a bowler's skill, or is it as it is independent of fielders? So that's why one of the reasons we look quite a lot at control stats and everything else. So you get a better idea through controlled stats. Even chances created doesn't... wickets and chances created only tell you so much. Because what if you got five edges in one game and they all go through third slip? Is that a chance created or is it not if there's no field there, right? So the best way of looking at it is control percentage. And that gives you a good idea of how often the batter who is facing them is actually in control of each individual shot. Person says, have you heard from boards or any reputable sources on how boards would change their schedules with 4-day tests in the World Test Championship? I.e., some boards are really receptive and would hope small tests if it was 4 days, and some don't think it would move the needle. No, there's a few that just, look, it's cheaper. So most boards are pretty keen on this, if we're being honest. The other thing that's really important to note with this is that the countries who really like Saturday Sundays, and this is different in different places around the world, but the countries that really like the whole idea of Saturday Sunday, they are generally massively for this, right? Like it's a big deal for them because it opens up that part of the game to them. Yeah, not everyone at the boards agree though. Like I think if everyone agreed, it would have just come in by now. Like the fact that it hasn't kind of tells you that not everyone's on the same page with it, maybe is the best way of putting it. Neil says, do you look forward to or get more excited covering certain test series like a England, India or Ashes compared to something relatively more low-key? It's probably the other way around, Neil. I cover England, India and Australia so often that I don't think I get particularly excited about covering their series. Going to South Africa, which I hadn't done in a while for that series. I went to West Indies for my first ever series there. Was when I went back with TalkSport for Sri Lanka, that was only my second test series there, I think. But again, with a long time in between, probably the thing I get most excited about is World Cups. You know, I don't think I'm going to the Women's World Cup, but if I was, well, I might be going to the Women's World Cup for some of it. If I was to go to that though, that would be really, really cool. I get really excited when I go to associate cricket, because I don't see as much of it. So no, it's kind of the opposite, really. It's the stuff I haven't done. Look, I haven't covered Pakistan. It's the last time I covered Pakistan. Like, it's been a really long time since I've covered Pakistan in a test series. So I'm really looking forward to doing that next. And Zimbabwe. Yeah, I did it recently with Zimbabwe. I've never covered Afghanistan in a test. I haven't been back to Ireland since their first test, I think. So yeah, those are the things I would get excited over. I've done so many Ashes, so many India-Australia, so many England-India. Aravinda says, there have been a few articles in the last few years, particularly from Monga on Cricket Info, where he talks about the control percentages, and it feels like more often than not that the Indian batters end up having better control percentages, including at the Lord's Test, but it feels like there are many occasions where that doesn't convert to more runs or wins. Well, they were dominating world cricket for a while, Aravind, weren't they? Is that just dumb luck or is there another reason to it? Or is it just that my bias with these occasions where India have lost despite supposedly having better control numbers have been more imprinted? I would say the second one is probably the major thing. Like, how often have he would be my main question, Aravind. How often has anyone checked on the control percentages for any team that isn't India? Might be one of the more interesting things to have a look at. Control percentages don't necessarily mean that you are going to win the game. Again, so Mohammad Siraj went out the other day with a control percentage of 100%, right? And I've seen sometimes you can have two or three of those in a game, right? Short ball comes in, you absolutely whack it, short mid wicket. Takes the catch. You're in complete control of that. It just happened to be that short mid wicket plucked it, right? So you see wickets from that perspective. You see wickets from runouts as well. But within one game, I think this is right, based on the Crick Info ones, but I think it's Crick Info and Crick Viz are roughly the same, even if they're done in a slightly different system. There are 12 out of control shots for every wicket. But if you make 200, right, and that takes 300 balls, you might have 60 bad shots. So you're just like, well, that doesn't make sense. That means that player should have been out all these different times. But over a period of time, Dean Elgar or Rory Burns is probably going to have a lower control percentage than James Vince, right? Let's say they face the exact same amount of balls. I would expect those two guys to have a lower control percentage than James Vince, but maybe still a higher batting average. And the reason is they are not always in control of the ball, but they nullify their mistakes. Shivnar and Chandrapal is a great example of a player who did actually edge quite a bit, but he played with such soft hands that it was very hard for his edges to carry, even in Australia at times, right? And so control percentage tells you a lot, but it doesn't tell you everything. There's also, it might be that the kinds of mistakes that Indian players are making in those games, or in general, are more likely to lead to dismissals, whereas the kind of mistakes that other teams are playing are less likely to lead to dismissals. As I said, let's call it the Dean Elgar rule. Right. And I haven't checked his control percentage, but I think he was one that I looked at. I know with Rory Burns that I had to stop looking at his control percentage because it was so bad every game. Right. That it was like, okay, but we have to understand why his control percentage is like this, because he does get more outside edges than other players, but he's very good at nullifying those outside edges and not getting them through. Whereas Johnny Bairstow might have a high control percentage, but his mistakes are the balls on the stumps. So he's either going to be bowled or LBW. So that might also play a part. But if you want me to guess, it's probably just because those are the games that you notice. Mob says, you have lived and worked all around England for some time now. Well, I've only lived in London, but yes, I've been here for a long time. And the charming diversity of English accents is well documented. Can you please give us a cheesy, funky line using your best, least shit, favorite British accent? So I'm not very good at accents. I'm not very good at controlling my voice and doing accents. I could do it like a bad German Nazi accent. I can do like an American DJ accent. I can do a couple of different versions of Australian accent. Don't think I have. I can't do a Brummie accent. I don't think I could do a Cockney accent. I don't think I could do a Somerset. Yeah. But if you want my best story of accents, it was when I was in, when my wife was watching one of the music shows where the judges are really bitchy, and Cheryl Cole was on, and I was like half paying attention, probably, you know, reading or writing or doing whatever I was doing on the side. And I turned to my wife and I said, is she speaking French? Shout out to all my Durham friends. Rob says, every LBW seems to be referred to the TV umpire if a team has reviews available. Would it make sense to have the on-field umpire make his decision and then refer it himself so the teams wouldn't lose a review? It's certainly not all of them. I just don't think there's a reason for that to have happened. Maybe if we ever get to a point, Rob, where it's 100%, but there are plenty that are not reviewed. The reason they're reviewed more than caught behinds and everything else is because you can still keep your review, whereas it's completely binary. It's either out or not out in the, you know, caught behind reviews or, you know, other kinds of reviews like that. So the LBW is not binary, right? Like, there are three options. You can be right, you can be wrong, or you can have umpires call so you retain your review. That's the reason you see more with LBWs than caught behinds. Teams are pretty switched on to that. Ali says, are you a believer of regional qualifiers or just top teams from across the world making it to the World Cup? I do like the idea of teams coming from different places. I don't know if cricket's quite there yet. So I would probably prefer there to be a regional qualifiers where you get, I don't know, let's say five teams from Asia, five teams from Africa, you know, two teams from the Pacific, where else am I missing? Europe, five teams from Europe, five teams from North America, whatever. Two teams from South America. And then they all play each other. And then the best teams come from there. I think that's probably better in the short term. But in the long term, I think we should, you know, you want the best African team and South American team and Pacific team. And, you know, but I don't know if cricket's quite there at the moment. It might be a better question for someone like Andrew Nixon or Peter Delapena, who cover this a lot more than I do. But from my perspective, I do like but if there are four great European teams and there are no good, you know, teams from other regions, I think that's a bit silly. But that's where we are at the moment. We should be moving towards that, I would have thought. This is the Wagon Wheel. Let us have a quick break, and then after that, more. Cricket boards actually make watching their games almost impossible now. I spend almost as much time trying to find where I can view it as I do actually following the action. That is why I use NordVPN. They let me find all the cricket I want to watch while protecting me from the nasty side of the internet. Nord will free your cricket matches. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/goodareas to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan plus 4 additional months on top. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch every match with NordVPN. Will says, which would the great West Indies sides have most benefited from if they could have been added to their side? Adam Gilchrist or Shane Warne? Shane Warne. Gilchrist would have been handy, but he doesn't really revolutionize their side. If you put Shane Warne in that side or Murali in that side, even Anil Kumble, like Ashwin, Harath, even if they don't play every game, you can't really scheme against that side, right? You could make an argument that Gilchrist in that side would bat at 6, which maybe gives them a little bit more flexibility in that way. But no, I think they would have been a much better side if they had a great spinner available to them all the way through. If you put Warne in, you can actually rest and rotate the fast bowlers more as well. No, how would you play that? How would you play against West Indies if Warne was in ahead of Croft or Roberts or Walsh, Patterson, Bishop? Like, how do you play that team? It's impossible. Sinoy says, on a podcast, Million and Wokes were discussing how good Root is. They were saying how the likes of Thorpe were able to see within a 6-ball duck innings that Root were going to play for England when he was young. What exactly the pros and coaches were able to see in such a small sample size that allows them to make this prediction about a player? What do you look for when making such predictions? So I got Root right almost instantly as well. So I don't know what it was about him that spoke to me in Graham Thorpe. And obviously, I got Virat right as well, but got Smith wrong, right? So I'm looking for signs that are repeatable, that are exceptional when it comes to how early they pick the ball up, how they think their way through certain situations, what positions they get into, and can they do it over and over again? So the reason I didn't get Smith right was because I hadn't seen anyone do what Smith had done before. The same reason I don't trust Zach Crawley to suddenly start making runs. I need to have seen it before, or it needs to look so acceptable. Like Mustafizur Rahman, right? Obviously never went on to be the great test bowler because of the injuries, and he wasn't the same bowler afterwards. But I could see how what he did would be repeatable. The same way I could see how Rishabh Pant, what he does can be repeatable, even if there hasn't been someone before them. But generally, there is a player like that before them that in your mind you can kind of comp them to. And I think with Root, it was the thing that I noticed was just how he played spin. He seemed to completely understand spin, and he had no issue against pace bowling or seam bowling as well. And so it didn't take that many balls to be like, well, where do you bowl to this guy? Whereas with Ollie Pope, and I still thought Ollie Pope had a chance of fixing this, but with Ollie Pope, who, remember, at one stage England were thinking he was going to be the next big thing, right? I was like, I don't think he can get off the strike against spin. So the minute I think there's something like that, that means everything else in the game has to be exceptional. And I didn't see that with Pope, even when he was making runs. There's one article where I was like, maybe I'm wrong, and here, maybe this is the next big guy. And I wasn't. And I, you know, that's, you know, sometimes people keep making runs, but eventually he's been brought back down, right? So that's kind of what you're looking for. Dom Sibley is another one where I was like, You know, straight away, what I'm looking for the fact, well, he can't really score on the offside without just pushing for a single because they don't have cover, and they don't have a cover because he can't play a real shot. So Renshaw was another one where it's like, I don't know how you can play in Test cricket without the ability to have a cover in. Because if you don't have a cover, you always have an extra slip. And if you have an extra slip, eventually you're going to nick off, right? The same with, you know, not be, you know, modern Ben Stokes. I know it's not quite the same, but I'm looking for the same things. This is such a name drop. But I was talking to Chiteshwar Pujara the other day. He was nice enough to give me his wife's book, and we sort of swapped books for a second. And we were chatting around that. And we were talking about Wokes. And we're talking about like how he's just got no options against the spinner anymore. So his options used to be the slog sweep. And he was so good at that that it meant that you always had to worry about him a little bit because he could put you over the ropes two or three times. He doesn't seem to be able to do that anymore. And so his only shot now is a reverse sweep. I don't think he's a great player of the reverse sweep. He can't use his feet. So he's just stuck on the crease. And he's so worried about the LBWs that he's actually bringing LBW more into play. So he's either lunging at the ball or getting stuck. That's what I'm looking for with a younger player, right? All of those same things that I'm looking at with Stokes. And the same with bowlers. What I am looking for is, what's their stock ball? And is their stock ball dangerous? How are they going to get wickets at the test level with the skills that they have, right? So, you know, I put a lot of time and effort into Cook. Like, I can see that with Cook's ability to move the ball away a decent amount and bring it back a long way, he should be able to keep slips and the wicketkeeper interested and LBW and bowled. But it was also very clear that he couldn't really bowl short. He didn't really have a plan B. It was just he bowled his best ball or it didn't. And most test bowlers need a plan B. And so that's what I'm looking for, right? If you're a spinner, is your stock ball dangerous enough? I'm much less worried about variations. Is your stock ball dangerous enough? And that's what I'm kind of looking for, those kinds of predictors or elements or however you put it. PJ says, is a sport that can have its statistics broken down, nitpicked and debated as much as cricket, baseball. As cricket fans, we're both equally cursed and blessed at the same time. Having said that, why did we end up using average instead of runs per innings as the main batting metric? Not outs can inflate an average so much. Is this really a true accurate assumption of a batter's potential score? Yeah, runs per innings would be terrible, PJ. Because if you bat at number 8, your runs per innings might be like 22. And you might be averaging like 40. Like, those are not comparable at all. So the number that you come in doesn't work. Averages over a long period of time actually are really good. There's just many other things that we can look at as well. Like, we never discounted average for the art of batting, right? Like, it wasn't like we said to ourselves, we're not going to use it. We used average. We used averages in many different things, but there are just other ways of looking at batters as well. But I think if you compare cricket and baseball, like, average is way better than RBIs. Like, RBIs never made any sense to me as a sports fan. Like, whereas averages, I'm like, yeah, I get it. And yeah, they can be warped a little bit, but that's why we should be looking at medians, right? That's why we should be looking at match factor. That's why we should be looking at error factor, right? It's why we should be bringing in strike rate. All these other things are really handy, but I still think average is a fairly, over a 50-game period, I think average does tell you quite a lot about a player. And when you say that it can be warped by a not out, that's because that player has the ability, because of the way that Test cricket is, to go to that level, right? Like, if you have the ability to do that, then you're going to warp it anyway. I would assume that RBIs can be warped by, if you're Babe Ruth, he probably warped RBIs as well, right? Like, not that I've said that's a good one, but I'm saying there are probably other steps that you can warp as well. Sandeep says, the dynamics of YouTube videos is more or less discussed, but podcasting, the audio part, is a big black box for people other than creators. Can you please explain how many listens a successful podcast gets and the economics? I don't know. Define successful. I think if you could get anywhere between 5,000 and 10,000 listens/downloads a week, and they all count these things differently. I don't know how much I trust podcast listens, but the people who do listen, I know really listen. Whereas YouTube views, you get a lot of views, but that a lot of people just click off after 4 seconds, right? Like, whereas podcast seems to be things that people actually listen to. So I would say 10,000 people listening on a podcast is probably more use to you from a, like if you're a sponsor, than 30 or 40,000 watching a YouTube video. But that sort of disappeared a little bit. So when podcasts were at their heyday from an advertising point of view, which is probably 2018 to 2022, say, before YouTube sort of takes over again, when they're at their heyday, you could make so much more money with like a sixth of the views / listens on audio podcast, because people weren't skipping ads, because most people were like working out or walking on a train or in a car, whatever. Like they didn't have their phone in front of them. So podcasts worked really well from that. Secondly, radio advertising works much better than TV advertising. There's some sort of science to the way that our brains work on that, but I've been told that quite a bit. And so, and podcast audiences are a little bit more engaged in general, right? Like, you know, there's more of a relationship with someone when you're listening to their voice than when you're kind of half watching something, you know? So I think there was all that. So during that period, you know, we did really well economically with our podcast. We had like 50,000 YouTube subscribers. And, you know, we were getting, you know, we had some algorithmic years where we got crazy numbers, and our audio podcast made more money every time. Our audio podcast made more money up until recently, really. And I say recently, maybe 2023 was when the changeover happened. That's really when podcast advertising kind of died. Up until that point, we made a lot more from that. So it's a really intimate, you know, we put ads in YouTube and we can see the dips are pretty substantial. People are just fast forward through them more often than not. I don't fast forward through ads on podcasts unless I have my phone in front of me, right? Like if I'm cooking and listening to a podcast, if I'm exercising and listening to a podcast, chances are I'm not going to do it. Maybe, you know, sometimes, but I certainly don't do it all that much. So it's very different. Whereas, you know, if I'm watching something on TV and I have the chance to fast forward through an ad, I fast forward through it, you know, 99 times out of 80. So it's very, very different from that point of view, I think. It's just a very different medium. I found over the last couple of years, and I've talked to The Great Cricketer about this. I don't know if I've talked to Final Word, but there was another podcast I might have talked to as well. I think all of our listens have plateaued a little bit after steady growth over years. But I think anything over 5,000, you should be able to get a sponsor. Certainly over 10,000 a week, you should be looking at, you know, sort of major sponsors. And, you know, who knows what the big ones get. But it is a black box. That's what we found really, really frustrating with it in general, was we didn't know what our podcast was worth. We didn't know how to get advertisers. We were just really lucky. Manscaped came in and then a few others did. Lemon says, what makes a good wobble ball? Are more or less wobbles good? More wobbles are less predictable. Less wobbles can swing. Very hard to swing a wobble ball anyway. So, you know, the best wobble balls, I would say, are the ones where the bowler has an idea of which way. The best wobble ball bowlers should be able to get the ball to move a little bit in both directions. So whether it has more wobbles or less wobbles, I don't think that's actually what it is. It's something to do with the wrist and how you put it into your fingers. When I was doing my research, everyone told me it was impossible to get the ball to wobble both ways. So in-swing bowlers wobbled it away and out-swing bowlers wobbled it in. That doesn't seem to be the case anymore. So I'd say a good wobble ball is that. And then a good wobble ball bowler also has the ability to go back to swing when the ball's swinging, you know, which we've seen with Bumrah, right? And Cummins and Anderson obviously was really good at that. I saw Kartikeya on Cricketing View recently was saying that Anderson wasn't a swing bowler. Well, Anderson was a swing bowler for what, 10, 11 years in Test cricket. Then he becomes a wobble bowler. But if you watch, when he needed to swing the ball again, even later in his career, he would do that, right? And that's the next evolution. I think that was the big issue that we're starting to see with some of these wobble ball only bowlers is they have nothing left to go to, right? It either wobbles and it does something off the pitch, or they bowl dead straight. Person McPersonface says, in a Wagon Wheel question a few weeks back, you described Paul Collingwood as basically a club cricketer. Can you elaborate? Because I looked him up and he averaged 40 in Test cricket and captained a team to a T20 World Cup. I'm not doubting you, but it's just an odd juxtaposition. So most people who play with Paul Collingwood would say that he was someone who did not have that many exceptional skills. He worked really, really hard and was just a really naturally smart cricketer at working angles and understand. I mean, I would put probably someone like Adam Holyoake would be another cricketer that I would say is like, you know, basically a club cricketer. James Hopes for Australia was another one. There was another one I was thinking of recently that would come through where these guys don't have like high-end exceptional skills in the ways that most players do, right? But they have their ability to read through situations, to be very smart, to make themselves incredible professionals, to find edges, you know, and everything else, takes them from that level of sort of club cricketer all the way up, you know. And it's a very rare thing, and we don't see it very often because generally you have to have the most. And I would say that, you know, Paul Collingwood making himself into a great fielder, he had the athletic qualities of an international player. But if you go back and watch him bat, he didn't have some of the more exceptional qualities that you probably needed. But he was so smart in what he did that he could sort of make that work. Lee Jamon would probably be another one I would have from New Zealand, who, again, none of these players are not good players. Like Lee Jamon probably didn't do great stuff in international cricket, but did some, you know, played some great innings below that. But their super skill is probably professionalism, angles, doing the right things over and over again, being in the right situations, those sorts of things. And that's like a club cricketer. Evan Gulbis, right, was a club cricketer who played for played in the Big Bash. I'm trying to think of some other ones that we have seen. Yeah, so you occasionally you see these guys and they come through and you're like, well, there's no elite skill here. Andrew McDonald might have been another perfect version of this. Athletically, maybe they're a little bit elite, but like Andrew McDonald probably wasn't exceptional at any single thing, but because he was a really good fielder, a really good batter and a really good bowler, which again, you go back to someone like Collingwood or Holyoake or Evan Gulbis or... who was the other one I was going to say? Even someone like Lee Jamon, who probably adds captaincy to that. They're doing all that working. Sikandar Razak would be the perfect example of this, right? Another version of this where they just keep improving. They just keep working things out where perhaps other players get stagnant and they're always looking for an edge or a way of doing things or maybe just a method that works for a little while and then they switch that method to something else. I was a huge fan of Paul Collingwood as a player. Just massively so. He's kind of disappointed me as like a coach. I thought he would go on to great things because I could see what he was doing on the field and I knew that other players were picking the ball up quicker than him, right? And his ability to do that. Peter Boren from Netherlands, another one who basically, I think might have even admitted to this to me once in an interview. Like he's another guy who's like, he got everything out of his skill set. There are guys in club cricket that are way more talented than him that never maximize themselves. That's what like a great sort of level club cricketer is like. All right. And I'm sure they go all the way through history as well. Let's have a quick break here. And then after the break, we'll see if there's any YouTubes. Brian Lara used pot plants to work on his placement. John Wright glued his glove to his bat. Sachin Tendulkar dug up practice pitches. Tatenda Taibu cut the top off his bat. Claire Taylor used a hockey grip. Steve Smith was from tennis. Dean Jones would call phantom runs. And Victor Trumper turned the Nets into a war zone to survive. The best batters in the world do whatever they have to make runs. We have told their stories in our new book, The Art of Batting. All right. Anurag says, older cricketing countries started with tests and have a strong sense of tradition and a history in the format. Will newer nations such as Afghanistan, Bangladesh, Ireland, etc. ever get a chance to build that? No, not as it currently stands, but who knows what the future of test cricket is, right? Like, it could not exist and so they'll never get to do it, or it could exist forever and it could get bigger and better and I don't know, whatever. So, you know, things are going to change quite substantially. As it currently stands, no one is going to be able to add to what they do unless they're in the top, in the World Test Championship anyway, right? Because if you're the ninth best test team in the world at the moment, okay, how are you even going to get in the World Test Championship? There's no promotion and relegation. So you have to be in the World Test Championship to begin with. I think all these things will change, though, going ahead. Kunab says, why is cricket not more popular than rugby in Australia? It is more popular than rugby in Australia. It is more popular than Aussie rules in Australia. It is not more popular than rugby league in Sydney and Brisbane and the sort of heartlands. And it's not more popular than Aussie rules in Melbourne and Adelaide and Hobart and Perth. But if you look at it as a national sport, it's the only really national sport, right? Or the main, I mean, you've got tennis and swimming and, you know, some of those other things. But realistically, cricket is the only major national sport, right? Basketball and football and just a little bit further behind, but they're nowhere near where cricket is. The country stops for cricket in a way that it really doesn't for, like, I've never been to a rugby union or a rugby league game in my life. Most of my life, we didn't even have a rugby league team in my city. I played one rugby union game, I think. Was it union I played? Yeah, I think it was union I played. So when I grew up, not a single person would have known who maybe we would probably know people like the major players, sort of, I don't know, Wally Lewis type players, George Gregan type players, you know, whether it be union or league and I'm talking about in Melbourne when I was growing up. This might be slightly different now. There wouldn't have been anywhere in Australia where someone wouldn't have known who, you know, the Waugh brothers were and Alan Border was and Shane Warne was, right? And Adam Gilchrist and Glenn McGrath. Like, you might not have followed cricket, but you still know those people. So there's a much big, that's way different. Whereas the fourth most famous rugby league player could have been sitting next to me and I wouldn't have known who they were. So it's weird. So in some ways, rugby league and Aussie rules are way bigger than cricket. They make more money in Australia than cricket does. But it's not exactly right to say that they're more popular. It's that football leagues generally make more money than cricket leagues, which is why we're moving to T20 cricket. So I think that is a big part of it as well. But rugby leagues, yeah. I mean, I don't know much about the history of rugby league and how it got so big in New South Wales and Queensland. And also why it didn't get bigger in the other states. Like, because I just don't know that much about rugby league. Aussie rules is obviously massive. It's interesting that you haven't mentioned Aussie rules here, but that's a massive sport in Australia. And I would say that's the biggest sport in Australia. But again, there are huge parts of Australia where they don't really follow Aussie rules all that much either. So it's a very segmented country in some ways, and geography probably plays a big part in this as well. But yeah, I don't know, people like rugby league, I suppose. I think rugby union's the better version of rugby of the two. Like, I should say more enjoyable to watch, but for whatever reason, rugby union's not that big in Australia. Anurag says, is Seals the most underrated seamer at the moment? How does he compare to the modern greats such as Rabada, Cummins and Bumrah? I'm not aware of his match factor, so it could just be West Indies home decks. I think that plays a part. I think we've also, the one thing I'd say with Seals is if you've watched it, and I don't know how much you've bowled it. You've bowled him? You probably wouldn't have bowled at him. I don't know how much you've watched him. The thing with Seals is, I haven't looked this up recently. I think he's a great new ball bowler. And he's probably a great bowler with the Dukes for longer in the innings. I don't know if he would be, he doesn't have second and third skills. So his first skill is incredible and has been, but he is pretty much an 82 mile an hour hit the wicket bowler. He can't really bowl bounces. He doesn't, you know, swing the ball that much if it's not seaming. He's accurate, but he's not maybe Philander-like accurate. Like, I don't know where he fits in once the ball or the pitch have gone out a little bit, but he's absolutely brilliant with the new ball. I don't know. I think Blessing had the best record with the new ball. I don't know where he fit in, but I wouldn't have thought he would have been that far away, someone like Blessing. But yeah, I've been a big fan of him for a long time, but I don't know if his game will travel as much as those other guys have, right? Like, I think that's a really important thing to remember. I don't think we've had a look into him recently, but I did a while back. Alex says, I just want a 2-minute rant on Sonny's crap commentary. I don't think I listened to it. I mean, I'm commentating myself, Alex. So from a test cricket point of view, I'm not paying all that much attention. The IPL, I've said this before. I don't, when he says something, when he's really thinking and he's engaged, sometimes he will say something that I've never heard anyone else say. And I just, and Warren would do that as well. We just like, oh, these guys are just geniuses on such a ridiculous level, but they are not brilliant communicators. I don't know how much Sonny loves commentating. I mean, he seems to really like it, right? Maybe he's happy with what he does. He's older. Sometimes older commentators as well just get caught in a bit of a loop, saying the same things over and over again. And that's really tough, especially if you're not developing and moving with the game, right? Like you do that. So I don't know if I have a 2-minute rant on his commentary. Yeah, but yeah, I don't think I do. Sorry. Does Bill O'Reilly have a case to be the greatest bowler of all time? First class average, playing mostly in Australia, is under 17. Ridiculous for his era. Grimmett was at 22. The greatest bowler of all time? Probably not. O'Reilly a great. It's a combination of a few different things. But I think because he bowled leg spin so fast, it meant that, and accurately, right? It's a combination of those two things. Most leg spinners aren't good on wet wickets, whereas I think O'Reilly was great on wet wickets. So he gets the drop that finger spinners get on wet wickets, but he was also great on flat wickets, which finger spinners generally are not, right? So I think he gets the double bubble there, which is one of the reasons he was great. He's always been one of my favorite cricketers of all time. I don't know, the greatest bowler of all time is tricky. I've never really gone through his first class record as close. So it'd be interesting to go through his first class record. But I could tell you that idea, you can make a claim that he's a better leg spinner than Shane Warne, right? Like, you just can make that claim. I think he would have bowled better in India than Warne as well. But Warne obviously goes well beyond him, you know, in terms of the amount of wickets, and Warne was incredible. And also Warne did it in a period where, like, Bill O'Reilly did it in a period where spinners were still dominating everywhere. Warne doesn't appear where spinners stopped dominating. So it is a little bit different. But yeah, I love Bill O'Reilly. He's one of my favorite cricketers. Would always try and read his books when I was a kid and everything. But I don't know as much about his first class record. I definitely think he was a better bowler than Grimmett though. Partly because of the extra pace. I think if you were a good player, a good user of your feet, you could at least play Grimmett. I think O'Reilly made it really tough because it was hard to use your feet to him because he was very fast for his era. I don't think he'd be fast compared to bowlers now. I think he'd probably be more regular or even, you know, maybe slightly on the slower thing. But I think if Grimmett was basically going, whereas that, you go back, there's some great footage of Bill O'Reilly bowling. He was a lot quicker. For then and now. The scene uploader says, how's the Old Trafford pitch historically and now? It's had a couple of different periods. It can be quite hard and fast at times. It's had some really epically flat periods and zones at times. Quite often it's a good pitch for wrist spinners because of that. So, I don't think it's a surprise we've seen someone like Matt Parkinson come through Old Trafford. If you bent your back, you get good pace and carry and bounce on it. It's, at the moment, it's just really flat. It's not really helping bowlers at all. I'm most of this is on Bumble, who does a lot of commentary up there. And he's been really, really negative on that wicket. And I've looked at some of the records. So yeah, it's become a real batting wicket and people are struggling quite a bit on it of recent times. So that's what I have for you recently. Seam bowlers have always done okay up there. You know, Statham and Anderson both come from up there, right? Like, that region of the UK certainly does it. And the extra pace and bounce was that and the oval were two of the wickets that I think the West Indians liked bowling on. It can be quite, it can have some good pace on it at times. I don't know if it's quite that wicket anymore, but yeah, of recent times, a lot of the English wickets are changing because of drainage. Right. And they have been for a long time. If you follow George Dobell, he's been on this for about 15 years. And it's meaning that the moisture in the grounds is not there in the same way. So early in the season, you can keep a little bit of moisture in the wicket because the grounds are still cold and wet and damp from the winter. So April, right? Once you get to May, and there is a bit of global warming probably plays a part in this as well, you know. This has been a dry summer, not particularly hot summer, but you know, it's a couple of years ago when it was like 40 degrees in London. It's not a normal thing that you would expect to have in London. So it's changing, right? Like it is all these things are playing a part. I think if you go back, there's been some very flat wickets in Old Trafford before. Like the Bob Simpson, when Bob Simpson made his runs, that's supposed to be one of the flattest wickets of all, not having got Bob Simpson, but that was supposed to be a very flat pitch as well. So yeah, you can make a lot of runs there. I'm trying to think, was there a Pakistan test where everyone made runs? I know I was at a test where that happened. But when the moisture's around, it should still do something. But yeah, we're not massively expecting that. That's it. Thank you to the Scene Uploader and Srikanth, Alex, Anurag, Kunav, and Anurag. Double Anuragi. There. Thank you to everyone as well over on Patreon. If you're desperate to have your question answered, Patreon is obviously the best place to go. We'll be back shortly. I think me and Bayram, looking back at the test because we haven't had a chat about it. What else do we have coming up? Oh, we've got a video on Siraj. Hopefully next week we'll have a big one on Pope and maybe something else for the weekend as well over on the main channel. Go over to goodareas.co, but patreon.com, Good Areas Podcasts. I don't know, something will come up and you can find stuff there. Go buy The Art of Batting. I don't know, do all the things that you should do. Support your favorite content makers and they'll keep making content. Bye for now. Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bayram Kazi and Estelle Vasudevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.